everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is Points on the Board. I hope everybody had a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. To my non-Christian friends, I hope you had some happy holidays. We are back on track. We took some time off. We were actually supposed to do another show, but Bill did not tell me he was traveling, my co-host. So we couldn't talk about Bill's favorite Christmas movie. So we'll have to hold off on that until December of this year. But we got something even better for you today. Big Bill has been complaining, as have we all, about the college football playoffs. So he's going to give us his perfect scenario in a segment I have titled Bowl Games or Bowl Gamesmanship, Decoding the Dance of the College Football Playoff Seeds. I'll decode it for you in one word: manipulation. Two words: corruption. Three words: fix. It's set up for the major powerhouses to always be involved, to always have the top seeds. And in essence, it's for them to not only get all the football glory on the gridiron, but also to rake it in financially. That's my personal thoughts, but we will hear what Big Bill has to say, and we'll hear what his proposal is. Then we're going to talk about Black Monday strikes early. Hell, Gerard Mayo of the New England Patriots did not even make it to Black Monday. His unexpected dismissal and the NFL coaching carousal we will talk about. That includes, I want to say his name's Carson, or the Lions offensive coordinator, Brian Flores. They actually had the audacity to say he's a hot candidate, especially after the typical shellacking his defense took against a team that understands his blitzing schemes, and he never changes up. It looks great to pile up 100-some-odd sacks off your blitz schemes against average teams, but when you play an elite team, you better know when to blitz and not to blitz, and he still hasn't learned that, as we saw last night in the Sunday night game where the Detroit Lions embarrassed his defense. And then we're going to close it out with what's going to be the story of this week and for the next few weeks, and then off and on as new information comes about. And that's Sex, Lies, and Undisputed. The Fox Sports scandal unraveled. Unraveled as quickly as Joy Taylor's top came off. And with that, my friends, let's get down to it with my co-host, the handsome Bill Ross, back from spending time with the family on the East Coast. Bill, how are you today?
Well, I'm terrific, thank you. I'm glad to hear you had a nice holiday.
Bill, you know, and I have to apologize to Bill. You know, your wife told me you get up early in the morning, so this is a late evening taping for you. So we will get down to it and make sure you get your beauty sleep. But that said, any highlights from I heard old Big Bill almost got rough and tough in the restaurant there.
Yeah, almost, you know, a little problem with accessibility at the tables in the bar, and one suggestion led to a few rude remarks by the manager, so I had a couple things to say, but I tried to stay out of trouble. White Christmas in Connecticut, can't complain.
Connecticut, I thought you were from New York. Is it Connecticut?
Connecticut, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, Connecticut's as blue as New York, isn't it?
Well, not in some of the southern spots aren't, but yeah, it's blue, unfortunately, altogether.
Where's Bernie from? Is it Vermont or Connecticut?
Vermont.
Connecticut a gun state? Because I know, like, for example, Vermont's a blue state except for guns. They are very pro-gun in Vermont. So people don't understand Bernie's voting record, which right. I actually applaud because he's doing the will of the people. Is Connecticut a red state, a red gun state, or and everything else about it is blue, or are they blue across the board?
Last I knew, it was not really a gun state, right? I mean, a lot of the southern part of it is not into the guns. The closer you get to Massachusetts, I think there is more of that, but overall, it's not.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's get right on into it then, Big Bill. Let us talk about college football playoffs. You know, it's decoding the dance of the college football playoff season. So the overview for the audience here is, in the realm of college football playoffs, what looks like a straightforward journey to the championship, we all know is not. It's per bill. It's a choreographed dance where dominance and dollars take the lead and not dominance on the field. The manipulation of the playoff seeds is a big issue with him in terms of crowning, how it leads to crowning a champion. It's about ensuring lucrative matchups, preserving traditional bowl commitments, and securing TV ratings. The teams come last, in my opinion. We'll hear what Bill has to say about it. The manipulation is seen as an art form where strategic seeding not only affects who plays whom, but also where and when. And that can skew the competitive landscape. That's one of Bill's issues, and it favors certain conferences. So we're going to explore all of that. So, Bill, let's get into it. You know, talk to me. Let's start out with maybe some of the seed comparisons. This is your segment here. How's that sound with the discrepancy?
Yeah, sounds great. Well, you know, the interesting part about it is if you take the seeds that were for the playoffs and then just the way they were seeded at the end of the season, we'll get back into that in a little bit about my solution to it. But you have a seed 12. Arizona State was seeded 12 or ranked 12th, but seeded 4th in the playoffs, right? And Clemson came in 16th rank, seeded 12th in the playoffs. So you have some discrepancies between where these teams landed on ranking and then where they were manipulated and forced to in the overall playoff seeding. You know, Boise State was a 9. They came in at 3. So, you know, that really skews, for instance, like Penn State runs into SMU and Boise because of the way they were manipulated. It's a manipulation of the ranking into the seeding process. And, you know, that affects the purity of the, you know, the whole playoff system. So I think that needs to be addressed too.
Okay. All right. That seems very fair in the sense of your talk. So in essence, what you're saying is you don't like the way the strength of some of the teams are and how they're seated lower.
Yeah. I mean, because what they're doing is they're taking conference champions and giving them a higher preference, right? Even though they're ranked lower, you know, for instance, if Boise won the Mountain West, they ended up with a 3 seed and a bye. I think there's an easy solution to it in a pure seeding system, a lot more like the NCAA does in their basketball tournaments.
Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to that because I want to show the image in terms of your proposed matchups there.
Sure.
But you actually propose, what is it, a 12-team playoff right now?
16. It's 12 now, but I proposed 16.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So you're proposing a 16-team playoffs, no byes, and no conference championships. Explain that to us here.
Yep. So the buys, first of all, at the end of a college season, the buy doesn't help the team that gets the buy. You think like in the NFL, you get rest. They've already had a buy most of these teams during the season. And at the end of the season, you're gelling, you're in sync. A buy doesn't help you. So, you know, they have in this process, there's 4 buys for the 1, 2, 3, and 4 team, which this year was, you know, Arizona State, Boise, Oregon. And I think the other seed was it was ASU who had a bye. So Oregon, it doesn't help. So I'd remove the bye week so that you continue playing in your normal schedule. And then also as well as that, then expand it so you can get rid of the conference championship as well, which is actually an extra game that's not needed when you're expanding the playoffs like this, because teams are also penalized for losing that game. So I would say eliminate that game, right?
That's right. That's right. Cause some teams have fallen out of the playoffs and they'll only have 1 loss. See, that's the unfairness of the ranking system. It depending when you lose can affect where you go. And that's so unfair. Real quick, Bill, I don't want to push back because this is your domain and you played college ball.
Yeah.
But it seems like a week off to rest. I get what you're saying, momentum, and I agree with that. But how do you sit there and argue against the logic of like, hey, these kids are getting a week off in terms of resting up, you know, maybe healing up some injuries?
Well, I mean, you know, football is a game of playing with injuries, right? So, I mean, it's not going to make a huge difference if you actually have, you know, if you have injuries where you can't play, you're probably not going to be able to play in another week anyway. But you're giving these guys a couple weeks off by the time they come around and play the next week. And
Gotcha. Yeah. So that's right.
Yeah. And, you know, as an example, we'll get into this, but Ohio State's gelling, running on all cylinders. You know, Oregon took about one half to get going, and by then it was too late, you know, for them. But I think it's at a disadvantage to have a bye going into the playoffs.
I can see that from that in that sense, because they've already had a couple of weeks off. So then right. They get the bye week, you know. But one thing we can agree on, I hope, is I do like their logo that they have been using there. Looks pretty sharp there, very distinct, memorable.
Yeah. Really creative.
Yes. Okay. So let's talk about, okay, and I agree with you on the conference championships. The conference championships are dual-edged sword. The team on the outside looking in that makes it to the conference championship has their golden ticket waiting if they win. But the team that loses, even if they were ranked in the top two or three of the nation, well, maybe not that high, but if they were ranked in the top 10, odds are they're going to fall out and not qualify. And those two teams could be two of the more elite teams. So you're right. And I think that the conference championships, the 16 teams, oh, that's a scam. You're not getting the best teams. You're getting the fixes in with the specific teams that are already allotted a representative and everybody else is in that large. So I don't like that at all. Now, I wouldn't care if the brackets were as big as the NCAA basketball tournament, but they're not. And for good reason. But you're talking 16. I think in the future it's going to go to 32 and it'll be great. But that said, talk to me about the game locations.
Well, the other thing too is with the 12 team the way it is and the way they, in a sense, they reseeded the top 12, right? So you have the rankings. And then they reseed the top 12, and they might not agree with the rankings. For instance, you know, just using Clemson as an example, they were 16 on the ranking and got a 12 seed in the playoffs, right? So, or Boise State's a 3 in the playoffs and a 9 in the regular rankings at the end of the year. So, what was your question again? I'm sorry.
So in the first two rounds, you're talking about it should be hosted by the higher seeded teams, correct? And then the quarterfinals by the four major bowls, semifinals. Yeah. Okay.
Right. So the way they played it this year, the reason it looks manipulated is because with the byes and the way they seeded people, for instance, in the Rose Bowl, if you take the way they've done it, Ohio State and Oregon were almost not guaranteed, but it looked like you'd get the old Big Ten Pac-12 matchup for the last 65 years or more that they always used to get. So it's the old matchup. And, of course, who do you think wants that? The Rose Bowl wants that, right? And the same thing happened with the Sugar Bowl. The Sugar Bowl was designed to have the top SEC team and then an at-large team, right? The Fiesta, and that's what they got. They got Georgia and an at-large. In the Fiesta Bowl as well, used to have a, you know, the second big team, 10 team, and maybe in the ACC, and they got that matchup as well too. So, you know, there's a way to do that, but it has to be a pure seed. They manipulated it so they could get those television matchups, TV matchups that they used to always get, cause of, you know, assuming the dollars and the way all of those committees want it. So it looks like the way they reseeded it, they were playing and hoping for matchups, you know, on a percentage basis, which looked like they would happen. And that's what they're doing. You can expand to 16 teams and still include these four major bowls and then the two in the semis as you have up on the site right now. By just going to a pure ranking, the top 16 teams, and then have the two home games for the top seeds. And by eliminating the championship game, you have room for that one extra round before you get into the quarters and semis. And you can still include the four, you know, like you have Fiesta, Peach, Rose, and Sugar. And then the semis, the Orange and Cotton, and you go to a neutral site like the basketball does. And if you seed them or like the rankings are and then play the seeds like they do in the brackets, the 16 in each region – you come out with really interesting matchups, and if you overlay this year, there's not a bad matchup there, and I think you get a lot of better, a lot more games that were closer, more competitive. And the way they did it this year, we had a lot of games that just weren't that interesting after the second quarter.
No, they weren't. And in fact, Bill, to add to what you're saying, I think with the way these universities are leaving conferences and all that,
yeah,
and how some conferences are locked into bowl games, that's going to eventually go away because of the money and the demand and the fighting and it's the bowl games. This is a product of, we got to respect the bowl. We're tied into the Rose Bowl. That's a granddaddy, you know, all history and tradition, but money's going to force change. And what you're talking about, I think, will be the future. All right. So let's get into the hypothetical first round matchups that you're talking about. Let me pop this up here because I thought this was this gives a great hypothetical here in terms to what you're talking about with the seedings as an example here. What do you think? First of all, is this what you're talking about, something along this line?
Yeah, in a sense. So if you were to take some of the, you know, the rankings I was working with were from the national poll that also had the seeding for the playoffs, right? So. Right. I'm just going to – I'll run through a few of them. You know, Oregon obviously would still be the number one seed, and Clemson would be ranked 16th. So it would be an Oregon-Clemson matchup, right?
Right.
And then Georgia is, you know, still number two as the rankings go. And they'd have a game against South Carolina. Now, that's really interesting because it's a rematch from the season. It's an SEC matchup. And to me, that's a really good game. Now, Boise State shouldn't be number three, right? That's the reseed after the rankings. It doesn't make sense to me. So
but this is going by what was the seeding, correct? The actual
So what I'm doing is I'm taking the ranking and overlaying it like the basketball tournament. So 116, 215, and then you go to the next round. But the comparison I'm using here is the way they did it. They had Boise State as number three, right? If you used a pure seeding, Texas would be number three playing Ole Miss. And to me, that's a hell of a matchup, right? Because they replaced Boise State as number three.
You're right. The fact that a team gets a bye, this isn't the NFL. This is college.
No.
The fact that they play completely different schedules in terms of teams that never see one another, it's not like the NFL where there's only 32 teams. There's a couple hundred teams that, you know, between the top 16.
The thing, too, is if you give them a bye, see, the reason I think they give the top four a bye is because then it's easier to manipulate where they are and who they're going to play next, right? But if you do a pure ranking seeding system where you take the top 16 teams at the final, you know, after the season's done with no conference championship, and then just do 116 in a small NCAA basketball-style bracket, then the second round's interesting as well. So, that, you know, that's how different this is because you have, for instance, the number four Arizona State team as ranked in this season's playoff. If you were to take a pure seed, it'd be Penn State versus Miami. Now, that's a rematch of the Fiesta Bowl National Championship back in, I think, the, you know, late 80s, if I'm not mistaken.
Jimmy Johnson versus Joe Paterno.
That's a nice matchup. Right? And this isn't rocket science. This is just taking the top 16 teams and again, matching them up as they would in the NCAA basketball tournament. And
well, let's take it from what's listed here, too, because I think we may be confusing the audience with your rankings. And I apologize. Yeah. I should have taken yours. But this is according to how they were ranked with the reseeding, correct? Yeah. But it still works as an example. Nobody gets a bye. And to me, the important thing, and I don't know if you mentioned it here, is one, two, there's your four more teams. Nobody gets a bye. They're all on equal footing. No team has an extra. See, here's a kicker. Why does a team get a bye? Why? Because some old white farts had decided you're the number one seed. So you're going to get the bye. When in reality, there's no strength of schedule that they can play against each other or head-to-head like in the NFL where they can determine who truly deserves a bye. These are just picked out of a group. You get the bye. Right. You're ranked here. And people may say, no, William, Bill, there's reasons for this. No, it's all computer or uses data to help the people make their seedings. This gives true equality, allows four more teams – And I guarantee you, statistically, those top one and two teams won't make it to the final every year, more often than not, because of attrition, injuries, or just the wear and tear, but everybody's on the same level.
There's always upsets, right? And so if we take this overlay here to make it simpler, as you pointed out, the one versus 16 winner, if you're following the basketball format, would play the winner of 8 and 9 at the bottom, Ohio State, Tennessee.
Right? And that's the whole point. That's why it was set up for the show.
I'm following the way you did this. These teams might necessarily match up with my 16, but the point is that they would play. It would play 8 and 9, right? And then 2 and 15. Let's see, Georgia plays the 15th ranked team as well, and then they would end up playing the 7 versus 10. So it makes more sense for them to follow the basketball format, because it with no bye, it's clean and you can't manipulate it. The seed is the seed or the rank is the rank, and you just continue to go on. And then you get to the quarters, you give the Big Bulls their 4 games. You get to the semis, you give the 2 to Cotton or Peach or Orange, whoever it is. And then you play your final at a neutral site like they do in basketball. To me, it makes sense. They don't do it this way with 12, though, right? Because the byes make it confusing.
Well, it's also to keep the tradition of the SEC. People don't understand. These committees are dominated by the SEC administrative staff. So that's why they had Alabama ranked a week before the final playoff rankings as getting into the playoffs. Why? Because the fix was in. But the backlash was so great. The backlash was so great, it could have possibly triggered investigations of sorts, lawsuits of sorts. You know, that's the other thing we're entering. We're entering an era of lawsuits where you will see a school eventually sue that playoff committee for bias. And whether it's legit or not, it's just going to make it an ugly scenario. So I think eventually what you're proposing will happen. Any final words on this, my friend?
No, I just think we have to get to that because there's, as you said, corruption or manipulation when your final season is 1 through 16. It's already laid out, and you just fill the bracket in with 1 through 16, and you play your extra game. You get 2 home games if you're the top seed, and then you move on to the quarters and semis and, work your way in. And there will be upsets. It'll be interesting. If you take the top 16 teams from this year and you do that, there are a lot of interesting matchups in the first and second rounds.
I agree. All right, everybody, there you have it. Now, what Bill has talked about is no big secret. Most of us feel this way. You know, we want a big field, but we understand in football it can't be as big as it is in basketball, but it's BS. They can structure the seasons for all these colleges to start. You start at this point in time. You end at this point in time. The college football playoffs start at this point in time. Bill, you add 4 more games. Those are 4 more bowl games. You're talking big. This could generate in excess of $1 billion from beginning to end. It's control. The SEC and they allow a couple of other conferences in, like the Pac-10, which, believe it or not, the Pac-10 over the last 30, 40 years has been traditionally weaker than, say, the SEC, and that's recruiting. But the NIL is going to force a lot of this change, Bill. Before we go off that, how will the NIL impact your playoff scenario?
Well, I think you made a great point there. The NIL has balanced teams out, right? And the more teams and the more schools get used to using that, I think it's going to create parity, which will make a 16-team field really interesting because 16 can beat 1 now with the NIL. And that'll only get more interesting, and teams will become, much closer, and you're not going to have an Alabama that dominates or a Georgia that dominates all the time. Plus, with the portal, you might have a 4 or 5-star receivers like, I'm not getting enough time here. I'm jumping. So, it's really very interesting. I think it's a balance out college sports, and it'll make this field very competitive from top to bottom.
Well, here's the key, too. There are billionaires. There could be more billionaires that have graduated from, have become billionaires from UNLV than Alabama. Let's say there's a lawsuit. They got the pockets to sit there and take that fight. You know, because the lawsuit doesn't necessarily have to come from the university. It can come from somebody affiliated with the university that has, that can prove that, hey, I do have a stake in this and here's why. So this is going to blow up. I want to say sooner than later, because last year there were rumblings. We don't like this. We don't like they expanded it. And it blew up with the Alabama debacle where they wanted to get a 9-3 team. But look who they beat. I don't care. They lost even for as much as they beat a couple of ranked teams, they lost even worse to some scrub teams. So yeah. They didn't deserve to be in. And that's the rules that you guys, college football, have implemented. One or two losses, you're out. Tough ditty. You know, so at three losses, you're not getting in. So I thought, politically speaking, the right decision to get Alabama out of there was done. Now, a 16-team field, they could have had their cake and ate it too. But then SEC's greed kept one of their own out. All right, let us move on to Black Monday strikes early. Gerard Mayo's unexpected dismissal on Sunday. Before Black Monday and the NFL coaching carousel. So, Bill, just real quick, give me a concise take on your thoughts when you saw that Gerard Mayo didn't even make it the Monday. We got fired Sunday.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, you know, from the very beginning, that's been a fiasco, right? You know, he's had some problems with a couple of his players, and he's created and led with a friendly first sort of, you know, format, which never works. You can start tough and get softer, but you can't start soft and get tougher. So I think by the time the season was over, he probably lost the locker room and, you know, Kraft saw that, he probably had meetings with some of the players. And so it doesn't surprise me at all because it's a big, you know, winning's important. There's a lot of dollars invested here, and if it was a bad choice, you cut your losses and move on. And he was actually just a terrible coach.
Right, right. His press conference was marked with comments that were perceived as woke. I mean, and that alienated a segment of fans. But he still had a lot of fans rooting for him. My take was, dude, you have done nothing, absolutely nothing, except, I mean, Gerard Mayo and Robert Kraft. It wasn't a masseuse with Robert Kraft. They discovered it was Gerard Mayo there. Those two guys were making love to one another, waiting for Bill Belichick to be fired so he could instill Gerard. I think he got tired of Bill Belichick not respecting him, Bob Kraft, you know? So, hey, I get somebody I like. He likes me. He's not my lap dog. I don't have to be a bully of an owner. I likes this guy. But Mr. Kraft, between that masseuse there, if you could pause for 1 second, he has no coaching experience. You know, he doesn't care. I don't care. I got somebody who likes me, you know, and it backfired. As you said, there were locker room issues. Started out early. They could be losing the locker room. Those were some – we don't know how true it is, but we know there is some truth to it. Obviously, 4-13 record, you know, some of his coaching decisions, for example, Drake Mays, he's not playing Jacoby Brissett. Start of season, we are starting Jacoby Brissett. There was a time just a week or two ago, one of his running backs, so he's going to get a start. They start the game, he doesn't get the start. There was a third and one, and two straight running back plays. The press asked him afterwards, hey, what happened there? Why not? You got a big kid in Drake May. Why not just do the quarterback thing? That's right. That's right. You're right. We should have. I'm like, dude, you're just throwing your offensive coordinator under the bus. And he walked that back. So, there were issues that they say that Robert Kraft, the owner, did not know about, had not heard about when they were doing their due diligence as the season wore on. And I'm thinking, as the season wore on, what the hell happened with due diligence before you even thought of hiring him?
Right.
So some of these takes I've had, what you, any thoughts on that?
Well, the only thing I'll say is, you know, if you're Kraft, you don't think that he wants to have a great team after Belichick and Brady leave. I mean, he doesn't want his franchise to collapse after Belichick and Brady leave, especially Belichick, right? So, you know, all of a sudden, that's what happens. He doesn't want his fan base in the NFL and all the fans in the country to say, oh, it was Belichick, you know, and then Brady, right? You know, so he made a huge mistake, as you stated, going to this, you know, actually the alter ego of Belichick in coaching, right? So, you know, and that backfired, as you said, but there's no way in hell that he wants to have a bad, you know, couple seasons after, you know, Belichick leaves. So that, I believe that's why he cut him now, because he, you can see the writing on the wall for next season. So let's get somebody else in and try to rework it.
Right. Okay. So let's get to the final topic in terms of Gerard Mayo before we leave. They always make things about a race issue when there's a black coach, whether it was Lovie Smith. He's with Tampa now, the head coach of formerly of the Jets when he got fired. He's with Tampa now. He was given 3 or 4 years in New York and failed. So my response to these people who want to play that game, because Gerard Mayo may be a nice guy, but he was not qualified to be a head coach. And that's one of the things I do look at a lot of these young whiz kids. I'm like, dude, man, you've been a whiz kid for 1 or 2 years and you do well and you got a head coaching job. Heck, Gerard Mayo didn't even have that. You know, he was just a guy on staff who alienated some of the staff Belichick's final year. So I forgot to mention that, but that was an issue that Kraft found out about afterwards. And that doesn't mean that Mayo's a young guy. It shows that Mayo's immature. You know, just because you're a 38-year-old man does not mean you're mature enough to lead young men to become men. Some of the first-year coaches that were fired, Hugh Jackson, Mike Mularkey, Rob Chudzinski. That was a shocker. Should not have happened. Jim Tomsula, Chip Kelly. I thought Chip Kelly should have been given another year, but he lost the locker room. Steve Wilks just wasn't a very good coach. Heck, he didn't even last as defensive coordinator with down the road. Freddie Kitchens. I don't even remember Freddie Kitchens, to be honest. Wow. Urban Meyer, David Cooley. I don't remember him either. Nathaniel Hackett. That was a waste of a pick there. Lovie Smith, Frank Reich, and Gerard Mayo. So it's a plethora of white and black coaches. So it's just, that's just what happens at times. It has nothing to do with race. Robert Kraft realized he made a mistake in hiring Gerard Mayo. That said, when he made the commitment to Gerard Mayo, the only excuse I give for firing somebody is losing the locker room after before 3 years. If he hasn't lost the locker room, you give him his 3 years, unless he's that inept. And that was a situation with a couple of with Nathaniel Hackett. He was just so inept that they saw that. But that said, you think it was the right decision before we move on?
No, I really do. And I'll add one thing. The Chargers always stick to their three-year contract, and it's a disaster for them. So, if you make a mistake, you cut them. You're paying them anyway, by the way. It's not like they're not going to get paid. So, you know, you're paying the ticket. If you don't want him anymore, dump him. I don't think he's guaranteed 3 years if you do a three-year contract.
Well, they're not guaranteed. I just think you should give the person the opportunity to build something at least. But, you know, you never say never. All right, Doug Peterson. He's the first casualty. There should be more to come, but he was the only casualty for Monday. He was fired from the Jacksonville Jaguars at their promising start, including an AFC Championship game appearance. Peterson's team struggled in 2024. Did not meet expectations. According to Khan, the owner, this was the best team they had ever put together, and they only managed 4 wins. Some of the issues that Peterson had with management seemed to be team building. There was a discord between Peterson and Trent Baalke, who Trent Baalke, to me, has not proven much as a GM, and he survived. He should have been like, I would have fired Baalke given Peterson one more year. At least Peterson has won a Super Bowl. But and how to team build. And to give you an example on that, Bill, I think that team sucks. Its rushing attack sucks. They have no running game. What they have is a scat back as their primary running back. And when you're playing the NFL, there's times you just have to move that pile. And they do not have the ability to move that pile. So that kind of irked me. And I agree with Doug Peterson in that sense with that example. Game planning, this is on Peterson, but it doesn't matter how aggressive you are on your game planning and your execution if you don't have the players on the field. But there was some cultural and leadership differences. Peterson's loyalty to his coaching staff may have conflicted with management. I don't know. That's a bit speculative. But I think you have to be loyal to your team to a point. You know, if your guy that you're loyal to isn't getting the job done, then to help that guy grow, you got to let him go. The only way he's going to grow is by letting him go. You keep him on. All you're doing is continuing that culture of betraying your fans, your players, and your owner by being too loyal to one person who shouldn't be there. And then the moving down the road, I don't think there's going to be much player impact. You know, these guys adapt to a new coach real quick. What are your thoughts on Peterson? We're not going to spend a lot of time on him because at 4-12, I don't think there's a big argument in that he's been fired.
I just think my biggest take on him is that Lawrence didn't develop that much. And he's known as a quarterback guy. You know, and I think that's one of the reasons why they hired him, because they're, you know, they number one pick. It makes sense. He's a quarterback guy. He'll help him develop. And I don't think he developed at the rate that they thought he would. I don't think he's developed at the rate I thought he would. So I think that's a big part of it too.
I think he's a fraud as a quarterback guru. I think it was a fluke that he took a backup quarterback and won the Super Bowl. I think God had blessed him there. And I'm not knocking Peterson, but look at the immediate years, the 2 years he was there, the quarterback controversies, the lack of development of Wentz, you know, and once he left, Jalen Hurts started to develop. So I think his quarterback guru resume is a fraud, because you're right. Trevor Lawrence did not develop. And that said, maybe he's better off as a quarterback coach and developing them that way. Because I think as an NFL coach, as a college, as a leader of anybody, you have to be able to lead. And being a leader means tough and hard decisions, but it also means creating a tough mental framework. And that team is soft. That Jaguars team is soft. And I think Trevor Lawrence is soft. I think Trevor Lawrence needs a tough-minded head coach, and the quarterback coach can be the guru. But that team's a reflection of the leadership, and Trevor Lawrence is an underperforming, I'm not going to say the word I was going to say. I'm trying to be more nicer as we move forward. But he's very soft, to the point where you're a disgrace to where you were picked. You are not living up to expectations. We gave you a contract you did not deserve. Why they gave him that contract is sheer stupidity, and a reason why teams like the Jaguars are at the bottom along with the Cleveland Browns. You don't give that much money to somebody who hasn't proven squat. Yeah. So that's my take. I'll give you the final word based on what I said. I mean, it's toughness.
No, and I think it all comes down to winning, right? If you don't win, you're not going to keep your job. So,
exactly. All right. Head coach openings. You know, the Jets are looking at a head coach. Mike Vrabel is set to interview. Ron Rivera, I believe, already has. Rex Ryan, Brian Flores, McCown, Josh McCown. A bunch of names here. You've got the list there. I don't really care about who gets hired in terms of us discussing specific names. But what type of mentality do the Jets need?
Wow. I mean, who wants to coach the Jets? I mean, it's a place where coaches go to die, right? It's like the Bears right now. You need to have someone who's you know, gritty, a Mike Tomlin type, if I can use him for an example, whether you like him with the Steelers or not. Discipline, you know, hard-nosed, you know, get back to the basics, hold those players accountable, possibly get the players in that you want to play that style.
Okay. So you have that list in front. To the audience, I compiled a list of all the potential prospects going into the man. I just got, as I'm talking, I apologize. Sorry. I got tinnitus in my ears. I started talking. Who fits your mold there out of those? And while you're looking at that, to the audience, Mike Vrabel, Ron Rivera, Rex Ryan, Brian Flores, Josh McCown, Joe Brady, Matt Nagy, Arthur Smith, Brian Greasy, Aaron Glenn, Vance Joseph, Bobby Slowick, Ben Johnson. I'll help you out. I think Vrabel, Ryan, and Flores out of that list fit the what you're talking about. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but who do you see that fits that mold that you're looking for?
Mike Vrabel to me is a great pick because he's done it before. He's been successful, right, as a player. And then as a coach, he's done it too. You know, his time just ran out. So, you know, that he would be my number one pick. I would not go with a first-year head coach. I mean, you know, it's something that the Chargers used to do all the time, and it failed miserably for four head coaches in a row, right? Then they finally went to Harbaugh, and they're playing, you know? And they need that. And I would go with Vrabel. If you wanted to go with someone as a first-year head coach and take a shot, I'd go with Ben Johnson and pay the money.
Okay, you know, so here's the problem here with New York. They are a media nightmare. I think you're absolutely correct. You can't go with a young coach in New York. You need to go with a grizzled, hardened veteran coach. So to me, that's Vrabel, Rex Ryan, if he wants to come back, and Brian Flores. I just don't think Brian Flores is a very good coach, head coach. No. He's not a leader of men. He's your worst kind. He's a guy who loses the battle on the battlefield for you. His resume may look good, but when it comes to – I mean, look at the Vikings. When they play the tough teams against a veteran quarterback that understands the defense – Flores cannot adjust. If he cannot dominate and win Super Bowls as a defensive coordinator, what I'm trying to say is it was a tight game Monday night against the Detroit Lions. He let that game get away from him, and the Lions just wore him down and kept scoring. And that's when you need that defense to rise. That's when you need the big play. And when it came to make the big plays, his defense was nowhere to be found. And that's because I was telling my wife, watch, babe, you're going to see the player move out to the slot, the receiver out in the open. It's a timing pattern. It's going to be a count. He's going to throw the ball because the blitz is coming. And the running back's job is to be in that spot. Boop. A touchdown. I didn't see the touchdown coming, it was first down, you know, but you know, I'm not a player, but I've been watching the game since I was a child in the mid 70s. It's like you kind of, and then I did analyze the game for a living for a while. So if I can see that, Flores, you should be able to see that. Well, his guy didn't get there fast enough. Well, I get that, but then you don't call the play. You drop it back. You fake it and drop back. And I'm not telling him that's what I would have done, but you see that enough. You're like, you've got to start being able to bluff the – he's predictable. Every time there's a big play at the end of a game, he's going after that quarterback. And it fails him more often than not in big games the last few years. Anyway, we are going to talk about Ben Johnson. He is a hot prospect. But real quick, the New Orleans Saints, they requested an interview with Kellen Moore. They're looking at Joe Brady. They're maybe looking at Aaron Glenn, who I think played there for a while. That may be one reason. I can't remember. But the defensive coordinator, I don't like that situation. If I'm a head coach, I stay away from that because they are mediocrity because they always cook the books and they kick the can down the road with the salary cap. And all that does is produce mediocrity in players. You can have some solid top tier players, but you have no depth when attrition starts to hit the team. And that's what's kind of happened. That's why Sean Payton left. He saw they made a wreck of the salary cap with his help and he moved on. Your thoughts on New Orleans?
Well, I mean, if I were to pick a coach in that situation, I mean, New Orleans problems go all the way back to Bountygate, which we've discussed in the past. But that's where all their problems really started, and that's when Sean Payton left. The whole thing was a disaster. So they still struggle since that. But I would say that Kellen Moore would be my pick there. Creative offensive guy. You know, you can give him a chance. You probably don't have to pay as much. But not that that matters, but I think that would be my pick in New Orleans, you know, to give him a shot. It makes sense to me. You know, I don't know if Joe Brady, you know, is he going to move on? I guess it depends on what happens with the Bills, but he's going to
move on. If they get,
he's got to, it's like Johnson from Detroit, right? You know, you set a price tag. If you don't get it, you stay where you are. Right? And then eventually you're going to get your ticket. So I
view Ben Carson as unique in that sense. Those they're a rarity. You know, I don't view Joe Brady in there because when you look at Joe Brady, it's not his offensive schemes that have blown everything up. It's Josh Allen.
Right.
In Detroit, it's Ben Carson's offensive schemes with the maturing Jared Goff. It's been a consummate symbiotic relationship there. In Buffalo, it's Josh Allen. All right, the Bears. Thomas Brown is the interim coach after Eberflus was fired. They're looking at Mike McCarthy, depending on his situation with Dallas, Brian Flores, Arthur Smith, Ben Johnson. Who do you like there? Well, let's talk about Chicago Bears, and we're going to talk about Ben Johnson. Your thoughts on Chicago Bears? They got Caleb Williams. You know, how attractive is that job?
Not very. I mean, you know, they need a lot of help, and they're a dumpster fire too. I mean, just like the Jets, right? And, you know, they're playing in Chicago. They have great fans, but that's not a very attractive job. But if you want a head coaching job, you're going to take it anyway, right? You know, for me, staying within the division, Ben Johnson's interesting to me in that position. And that, I mean, he's a great coach anyway, but Flores and McCarthy, they're reruns. You know, and Flores, as you said, I don't think is
retreads.
You know, Mike McCarthy, I mean, you know, if Dallas keeps him, great, but I don't see a place for him after that. I think they're going to have a hard time getting someone, you know, to take that job. I mean, you know,
I got to be honest. To me, that's the most attractive job out of these teams. Look, in New York, New York, you have Aaron Rodgers' potential debacle there. You know, is he going to stick around? It's like you're kind of either stuck with. It's like, what do you do? They paid him a lot of money. It's going to impact the salary cap to a bit. They've got a playoff drought. It's a terrible city to play in terms of the media and the fans if you lose. In New Orleans, we talked about it already, it's their salary cap, and then they have a quarterback situation with Derek Carr. How good is he, really? So is he part of the mediocrity there, and they're paying him a lot of money? Then you have the Bears. They got a big old cap space. They got draft picks. And then they have Caleb Williams. I'm not a fan of Caleb Williams, but he's got the talent. If they can get a mature head coach in there who doesn't deal with his nonsense and his crybaby attitude, and he has shown none of that his first year. So I kind of view the Bears actually as the most attractive, you know. So with that said, though, potential firings, you know, they may let Mike McCarthy's contract just run out in Dallas. I think that's what they may do. So what are your thoughts on that? Do you think they're going to let the contract run out there?
I would. You know, there's no – Dallas is a complicated situation. I mean, Dak, he hasn't led them to anything, right? He's the highest paid quarterback, I believe, at the moment. He's led them to nothing his whole career there. So they probably let that run out and they go find somebody else. But Chicago, you know, the ownership is a bit of the issue there too. But if you're going to find somebody for Williams, Ben Johnson is your choice.
I would not touch the Dallas job because of one simple reason. Jerry Jones, and he's got like three children there running the team, and they're terrible at the salary cap. They overpay. They let players they should pay walk. It's just terrible. If I'm a head coach, I'm like, why go there? And Jerry Jones is not going to have the patience. He's in his 80s. He wants a Super Bowl now, so he doesn't want a coach that wants to rebuild. And there's aspects of that team that must be rebuilt, and they're hampered by mismanagement of their own salary cap. So I would stay away from that. Real quick before we move on to our major topic here, Ben Carson is this year's flavor du jour, whatever, soup du jour, whatever they say, and for a reason. The guy has got it done in Detroit. Everybody gives credit to Dan Campbell because he goes for it on fourth down.
Ben Johnson, you mean. Ben Johnson.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said Ben Carson. I keep saying Ben Carson because of my politics and Ben Carson, the magnificent human being. Ben Carson, my friends, if you're in the politics and you're a minority, he's a role model. Look him up. So Ben Johnson, their head coach, and I'm drawing a blank, who's the head coach's name? Dan Campbell. Dear God. It's Dan Campbell always gets the media or the headlines because he goes for it on this down, that down. Ben Carson is the guy who gets those first downs for him. Yeah. Dan Campbell is a consummate leader. He lets his X's and O's be done by his defensive coordinators. And I think in this day and age, that throwback is working to not only dominance the last 2 years, they are peaking. Despite an injury-riddled defense, this team has a legit Super Bowl shot. And I would not have said that 3 weeks ago. But they have matured. They have come together. And Ben Carson has turned Jared Goff into a legit overall number one pick who's finally living up to the hype. He turned down the Washington Redskins job last year. I think he may regret that a little bit, but I truly think he wants to win the Super Bowl before he gets his head coaching job. The apple or the carrot may be too much this time in front of him to turn a job down. Your thoughts on Ben Carson real quick, but more importantly, if he takes a job, where do you think he goes?
Well, Ben Johnson is the number one quarterback coach, head coach, offensive coordinator, in my opinion, right? So out of all those teams, Chicago, because they have a young number one draft pick. He can be molded. You can work with him. And that's a perfect fit for him when it comes to offense and personnel. And it's a young team. But they have a quarterback. The Jets don't have a quarterback, right? Dallas, I don't like Dak. I don't consider them having a quarterback. can't teach a, you know, can't change a tiger's stripes, so to speak. In New Orleans, they don't have a quarterback. So if you're looking at it from his perspective, Chicago Bears, that's his number one choice, I believe.
And I think I agree. In fact, I think he shouldn't go there, but the other situation that would be best suited for him would be New England. Stay away from New York, the media, the fans, the losing tradition, an owner who's always met, who, people don't realize Woody Johnson meddles a lot, more so than what the media talks about, because he's a owner that's in the background, that's not always in the headlines, but he does a lot, lots of meddling. So I think Chicago is his best situation. And with the McClaskey's there, they'll give him time to build a team. So I completely agree. I listed Dallas as a potential team that may fire. Anybody else you see that could be fired that we haven't talked about?
Well, I mean, personally, I'd let the Giants head coach go myself, but I think it's going to stay as is for, you know, the remainder now. I think they're going to, you know, they might be on a tight leash next season. But I think we've seen what we're going to see. So, you know, this off season at the moment.
I think Tampa Bay, if they get blown out or they don't advance, I think we could see a coaching change there. They are such a helter-skelter team that they made the playoffs in a weak division and they're not dominating, but they seem to have the tools in place. They got Mike Evans for maybe one or two more years. They need a head coach who can come in there and actually make a difference, and I don't think they have that right now, but we'll see. All right. Let us get into the juicy Peyton Place type story. And for those of you who don't know, Peyton Place was a soap opera shown in the evenings in the 60s, early 70s with Ryan O'Neal. And it was one of the very first dynasty Dallas type sexually dynamic storylines. And that's what we have with Sex, Lies, and Undisputed. So for those of you not aware, it broke just this morning. A lawsuit came out that sent shockwaves through the sports media industry because Nooshin Faraji, a former hairstylist at Fox Sports, has accused the network, along with prominent figures such as Skip Bayless, Joy Taylor is what you would call a sex pop, voluptuous, a femme fatale. She is that hot in certain ways. And executive Charlie Dixon. There are two people who run Fox Sports, the television side. One handles all the business side, the contracts and all that. And then there's Charlie Dixon, who handles all the talent, the direction of the shows, what kind of shows, etc. If what you see on camera, it's his hand that gives the final okay. So, for Regis, allegations include sexual harassment, discrimination, and systemic misuse of power. Now, I don't come from that industry, but I have tipped my toes in that industry with the NFL Network, with various independent shows. So I have done enough shows. I know the layout, how it works. I know how shows are produced, how they're done. And I know the soap opera drama that is in the show. So, real quick, let's talk about the current status of the lawsuit. The lawsuit was just filed. It meets several preliminary steps that must occur. There's a service process where they need to be officially notified of the lawsuit, the defendant's response, the potential for early dismissal, discovery, settlement negotiations. I do not see this lawsuit making it to trial. But if they don't get settlement negotiations going, there will be pretrial motions and then eventually the trial. Now, let me give you some context. Well, first of all, Bill, before we get into all of this, based on what I have just told the audience, and to the audience, Bill, when I hit him up, hey, Bill, let's talk about this. Bill's a working man. He works in stock. So he's up at 5 a.m. He's wheeling and dealing. Hey, I want this. I want that. Whatever stockbrokers do. He's the busy man. So he's like, what are you talking about? Bill, I filled you in. You've done a little research. What are your thoughts?
Like Fox News all over again to me.
Oh, you mean the Roger Ailes storyline?
Yeah, it just seems like, I mean, and by the way, I don't think this is any big surprise. This goes on everywhere. I mean, you know, ESPN back in the day when they were younger, they had problems like this all the time, you know, with their talent and controlling people and relationships and all this kind of stuff. I mean, All the networks do. I mean, this happens in companies too, but it seems to happen a lot more on, you know, with the networks. So this seems to be just like Fox News to me. I mean,
well, I'll give my 2 cents worth. I've worked with a lot of hair, you know, doing shows and all that. They clean you up, make you up, and they are people in the middle. They're like in the movies, the chauffeur or the butler who sees and hears everything, because they're in the green room with these people making them up. And you can look at the pictures, you know, she thinks highly of herself, physically speaking. She's not too bad. Like Jason Whitlock knows her. He goes, yeah, those pictures, she looks damn good, but she's not all that. I've seen her in person. I work with her. So, but it doesn't matter. Curvy, good looking. That's a weakness for me, you know? And she had none of that, though, what I just said. Her ties and her lawsuits deal with one person, Skip Bayless, and that Robert Redford movie. What was that Robert Redford movie where he said, I'll give you $1 million if you let me sleep with your wife?
Indecent Proposals. I hate that film. Yeah.
I've never seen it. I think the premise is so stupid. I don't even know what Demi Moore, I think, is in it. But anyway,
Harrelson and Demi Moore and Robert Redford. Yeah,
there you go. But that's what I thought of when I saw this. So let's get down to some of that is the individual who has brought the lawsuit. And I was kind of vague, probably threw out some confusing stuff. But in essence, she's this Nushin Faraji is alleging sexual harassment, discrimination, the systemic misuse of power. So there's no rape, there's no date, there's nothing. It's just an abuse of power. As Bill says, this does happen in many conglomerates. So let's start with Joy Taylor, because Joy Taylor is a hot piece who is supposedly a mean girl in all of this. And she's the one, she's just the main lawsuit against Skip Bayless, but she's one because of her actions. So I want to make sure I pronounce it correctly. Faraj, I wrote it down. Okay. Faraji. Okay. So Faraji is, alleging that Joy Taylor had sexual relationship with Charlie Dixon, the big Fox executive, to secure her position as moderator on Undisputed. She alleges that the relationship began right around May 2016 when Faraji suspected an affair after seeing them together in a notably manner at a social event. So she probably saw, she saw that. And it's claimed that this relationship was pivotal for Taylor's promotion, which also reportedly contributed to the end of her marriage shortly thereafter. Then she goes on to say that she accuses Taylor of having a sexual relationship with Emmanuel. Is it Acho or Acho? I can't remember. And he's one of the television hosts, had a brief career in the NFL. Hey, God bless him. All of us would love to play him. But in NFL standards, was pretty much a nobody, you know. But did play in the NFL for a few years, so God bless him. But Faraji noticed them together again, you know, in 2020, suggesting Taylor's aim was to transition to his show Speak for Yourself, which she was on. And this was, as I said, allegedly evident during specific industry events where their closeness was noted. You know, so then she has that in her back pocket, Bill. And you know what, though? Let me get a picture of Taylor, because to the audience, she's hot. She's smoking hot to many people. And I don't say that as a man. I say that as fact. Look at her. That is the look of a femme fatale, that image.
I don't know about that. I'm not on the same page with you on that, but that's okay.
Then you're in the 1% of the rest of America. It has nothing to do with me designing her as much as I recognize her beauty. You know, she's a beautiful woman, and she uses her wares. Now, that said, I did run across an article accusing her of plastic surgery, so maybe it's not all her. Who knows? Anyway, so Faraji went on to report an incident where Charlie Dixon, allegedly groped her at Taylor's birthday party in 2017. Now, let's talk about Dixon briefly. He's a power player. He is the number two guy at the Fox Sports network in terms of television shows. And I want to show y'all a picture. See, women have to be, and now I'm defending women again, y'all have to be beautiful. Men just have to have power. Because tell me, Big Bill here is a handsome devil. Let's say we give Big Bill a rating of 10. I give Charlie here a rating of 2. I mean, look at that guy. I mean, Bill, honestly, I'm asking you to step a little bit out of bounds, but is that a man who would rate, you know, having a relationship with Joy Taylor, whether you agree with how she looks or not? Is that a man?
You would have a London pub. I mean, you know, at 11 o'clock at night, it's awful.
What's that?
It's awful. It looks like he came out of a pub in London.
Yeah, he looks like he came out of a pond with algae all over it in terms of like the creature from the Black Lagoon. And that is not a handsome devil. And yes, I am cracking on his looks because my point, people, is to say this. Men in power can be the fuggliest people around. They're like rock stars. You know, it could be an ugly, skinny old rock star, but he's a rocker, so the women just crave him. As a man in power, Joy Taylor obviously saw something in that she could exploit. And that is what Faraji is actually accusing her of. So Faraji reported the incident with Dixon, that he groped her at Taylor's birthday party in 2017. So she confided in Taylor. Her response was to, quote, get over it, unquote, highlighting the dependency on Dixon for her job security. And she dismissed Faraji's complaint, and that underscored the power dynamics at play. So real quick, let's talk about Joy Taylor from your perspective. You know, sleeping – so this is all alleged. This is just what we got out of the court documents. So we're not saying it's true. But she alleges the affair with Dixon, then with Emmanuel. It seems to me like Taylor is has that picture there, the big one, to me, I see femme fatale. So when I see this story, I'm like, the image at least fits the femme fatale role. Your thoughts on that and the fact that she blew the hairdresser off, who was her close friend, like get with the program. Your thoughts.
It sounds to me like there's just a cat fight going on here between the two of them and a couple guys in the middle of it. Yeah, no, seriously. I mean, why is the hairdresser, I can't pronounce her name, so let me just call her the hairdresser. Why does she even care? Why does she care what she's doing? You know, that's the thing that I don't understand. She's putting her nose in all these other reporting people, and, you know, then she's filing her own, you know, suit, you know, and whatnot. So, she's a hairdresser for the company. Bill,
can I ask you a question? How old were you when you met your beautiful wife, Annette, and settled down?
I was 26.
So you were young. So take it from a sailor who has seen this over and over and over. And grew up with three sisters and worked in two workplaces where all women.
Yeah.
When I do the wow, jokingly, these women turn on one another like there's no tomorrow. There is something that we don't know about yet that has yet to come out. Maybe she was slighted. Maybe she was promised something. Maybe she, you know, who knows? But it does seem like a money grab. Because let's move on to Mr. Skip Bayless. Now, why do I believe her with the mean girl? Well, this, as Bill says, as anybody can tell you, this tends to happen a lot at these conglomerates in the sports world. I was just telling Big John, and I won't mention names, but when I was heavily involved in the NFL industry on a weekly, daily basis with my company, and then I would go to events. You know, I know the female reporters that were sleeping with players. You know, some of them were sleeping for some. It was they had greater access. It's just this does happen. So, but I would also believe the Skip Bayless side, except for the fact, Bill, she's saying that Faraji claims Bayless made repeated sexual advances with a consistent pattern of inappropriate behavior over time. You know, off the cuff, I'll go, yeah, I can buy that. You could buy that, too, based on what you said earlier. We're not saying it happened. We're saying the scenario is not an unfamiliar scenario. Now, the most notable incident was in July 2021 when, after Faraji disclosed a possible cancer diagnosis, Bayless allegedly offered her $1.5 million for sex. This was reportedly made during a private meeting with no immediate known response from Faraji detailing the lawsuit. Now, this is where I'm like, I don't believe that. Why? Skip Bayless is married. You don't withdraw $1.5 million without the wife noticing. Skip Bayless may be worth $50, $60 million, but that's not chump change. You know, and
she's not worth $1.5 million either, by the way.
Look, we're not saying this because we're pigs. Call us pigs if you want, but she is not worth $1.5 million. You know, so that's where, to me, the story falls apart. That's why I don't believe that aspect. That's why I believe she's hoping to have a lawyer. Maybe it's Tony Busby, because he seems to get a lot of money from all these people, to get a settlement. I think she's throwing everything out at the wall, hoping something sticks, and Bayless's people come back and says, we'll give you $100,000, get the hell out of here, or you know. So she's Bayless is accused of engaging in inappropriate physical contact, such as giving lingering hugs and pressing against Faraji during weekly haircuts. Now she better have witnesses, or this is just a simple he says, she said. And what is a lingering hug? You hug somebody, you let them go. If you can hug somebody for a second and a woman can say, well, that's a lingering hug. You know? I have been in situations as a single man when you're courting, and I have had lingering hugs. And there is no dispute of what a lingering hug is. So
what is a lingering hug? I'm wondering, what is a lingering hug in your eyes? I mean,
when you're pressing against each other. Well,
So I think she's missing the boat here. The Me Too movement's over. It just sounds like Me Too. So, I mean, this is quintessential Me Too. And that movement's gone with all the other woke bullshit. You know what I mean? And I think there's reasons for, there's some legitimacy to Me Too. Believe me, I have five girls. But I'm just saying that I have friends who were victim of Me Too, and I know they weren't anywhere close to what was said. So, you know what I mean? That's all this is.
I think what you're saying is accusations with nothing to back it up, with no investigation. It's like you have to believe the woman. And then during the Me Too movement, when some guys came out and accused some women, all these Me Too feminazis were like, whoa, we need to wait for the investigation. All of a sudden, now you want to wait. But when it came to the woman, you have to believe her. You know? So you're right. The Me Too movement has been exposed as – it was whether it was true or not, I don't believe it was ever a true movement. It was a political movement, you know. That started with Harvey Weinstein, and everybody jumped on the bandwagon, including all the people who, like Oprah, who never said a damn word about what Weinstein was doing. And it became a political movement. Now, the lawsuit suggests, moving on to Charles Dixon, she's accusing Dixon of groping her at Joy Taylor's party in 2017. She alleges that Dixon approached her under the guise of friendly interaction before he inappropriately rubbed her body and grabbed her buttocks. That cracks me up with it. He grabbed her buttocks. To me, that sounds more, I get that dirty mind view in my mind when you say it like that, then you sit there and say, grab her ass, you know? Yeah, it's to me, it doesn't help the situation out. But her immediate response was shock. I believe that. I was arguing with Big John. He was trying to defend Louis C.K. Yeah, see, there is no defense for somebody pulling his Johnson out and then looking at a girl. Hey, it's okay if I masturbate in front of you. There is no defense for that. You know, so and he goes, well, why didn't say anything? Well, because Louis is a powerful person in the comedic world. You know? And I had to explain that to our comedian and Big John there and Charlie Dixon. So I believe her response of being shocked, not choosing to confront him on the spot. So I'm not saying I side with her. I'm saying, hey, we don't know what's happening. How true was it? There were probably witnesses. And see, this is the whole shtick of all this. If she can't find witnesses, she's kind of screwed. Now, that said, it's probably open secret, some of this, and it'll come out in the fact that it's blowing up. Dixon's probably going to lose his job. Joy Taylor's probably going to lose her job. And this hairdresser may get nothing. But if anything, she's put some ultraviolet rays on a bad scene and can clean it up for a bit. Your thoughts on the power abuse here? The lawsuit suggests Dixon leverages executive position to influence career advancements, particularly for Taylor. Your thoughts on the fact this is a dual-edged sword? Dixon was not using Joy Taylor and promising her, it was seems like Joy Taylor was going, she was the one who was like, hey, you like my body, you can have it if I can get a job. It seems like same scenario, but different power dynamics. What are your thoughts when people bring the reverse power dynamics and what is traditionally seen as the man holding the power?
Well, I mean, the women actually hold the power because they have more, their bodies are more attractive and more beautiful than men, right? So I think the women have a lot more power than men in a sense to get what they want. But by the same token, they can also then reverse it and call bullshit on the guy. So they have all the power, I believe. And once they start using it, you know, as a man, you're like frozen. You can't do anything, right? I mean, this could have been simply, the hairdresser and Skip Bayless with that, you know, 1.5 million comment. You know, he could have been joking about something loosely, and then she's manipulated into this offer, right? I don't believe it was ever an offer, but maybe he was just, you know, bullshitting with her, right, or something. But that she has the power to actually then throw that on top, right? So, I mean, the men might have the final decision when they have positions of power in the company, but as far as power goes, the women have the power.
I agree, Bill. I do. I really agree. But people, I just cannot get over this. You know, it's that guy obviously had to use power. He's not the most handsome guy around.
He's using his position in the company, his power. He can't do anything else. There's nothing else that he's using. I mean, but the hairdresser, come on, William. The hairdresser, you know, was promised something at some point, you know, or whatever, and didn't get it from either Joy or, you know, one of the guys, and now she's just complaining and, you know, trying to grab on to the end of the death of the Me Too movement to try to revive it. I mean, it's silliness.
I agree. Okay, so what do you think happens? Let's say, looking at it as it is, how do you think this eventually plays out?
I don't think anything happens. I think that, there's nothing that backs up anything that she says. Like, there's no witnesses. It's just her word over somebody else's. And, you know, I think that other parties can come together to align themselves to make her look like a dope, you know, or someone who's doing it for a money grab, right? And the other people, they'll all come together, protect each other, you know, and the company. And I don't think anybody's going to bite on it. She's a hairdresser. I'm not putting hairdressers down in a sense, but in the position of that company, right? She's an independent contractor. I mean, but you know, is she employed?
Correct. She worked part time for X amount of years. She has some issues with that. She put it in the lawsuit. We're not talking about it. We just want to talk about the sexual part. Yeah. That's some more fun stuff to talk about. Yeah. But, before the audience though, I'm not going to put a poll on, and we're not live streaming, but if we were, I would ask the audience, let's rate him 1 to 10.
0.
If Bill is a 0, how many negative points is Charlie?
Come on. You know, can I have his job? I'll take his job. That's funny.
I'm just happy for that. I'm picking
one. No, that was good. No, but I mean, you know, come on, man. That guy, shit. He needs it. It looks like I tell my kids, brush your teeth. He needs a toothbrush too.
Maybe he's English.
Out of a pub in London. You know what I mean? It's like 11 o'clock at night. He's had a few pints. Hasn't brushed his teeth in a week or two. You know, no big deal. I mean, someone took a snapshot of him.
So what I think will happen, Bill, is I think if there's any legitimacy to this, and by legitimacy, if there's any money that's going to be paid out, I think the most vulnerable is Fox Sports because Charlie Dixon is working there. And odds are, just based off both of our experiences, we're not saying it happened. We're saying statistically speaking, the odds of Joy and Charlie, chicken down. It's probably some truth to it, but we're not saying it happened. We're saying statistically, it would not be shocking to us. How the hairdresser fits in we don't know. With Skip Bayless, that's a he says, she said, and the 1.5 million is going to be a tough sell to a jury. They sit there and say, I mean, he's going to look at her and go, I could have bought a whore for a couple thousand dollars. It's much more prettier and would have serviced my needs then. You know, plus 1.5 million. How do you give that past the wife? Maybe he can. Maybe that's money that I'm not accustomed to seeing. And maybe he could, but I think, and he's no longer at Fox, so it doesn't matter. So I think he's going to get a lawyer, and he may just go after her because he's not bound by Fox. You can't say or do this. So he's going to do everything to protect himself, and I think Charlie's the one who's going to be the odd man out. I don't think the hairdresser will get much, if anything, if there's that, of course, settlement. I think Charlie's most definitely gone, and Joy is more than likely gone if any of this is proven to be true, meaning if she slept with him and he sides with the hairdresser, Joy's toast. So he may spite Joy as he's going down. That's how I see this playing out. Charlie's gone. Joy's gone. The hairdresser may get a few bucks from Fox. And Skip is going to use her own court of $1.5 million against her. Do not worry. He'll have some court costs. Or he may just go, here's $10,000. Get the hell out of my face because I don't want to have to pay my lawyer a couple million. Or if he's like me, I'm going to pay my lawyer a couple million because I'm going to make sure you fry in hell because I'm not going to let you destroy and sully my reputation. That's, I always tell people, if it's your integrity on the line, you fight it. So that's what I would do. And I have done that in life. Before I close it out here, Bill, any thoughts on my take?
Well, I think hairdresser's gone. Everybody else survives.
Wow. Even yeah. Charlie?
I think everybody survives. I think, you know, a year ago, maybe not, but I think the tide's turning a little bit. But, you know, there's nothing that the hairdresser has nobody there to help her. She's gone. Everybody else survives. She'll be cutting hair somewhere. Maybe she'll need a Great Clips or one of those, haircut places for $25. I don't know. She'll be out.
Out of bail, man. You know what? With her notoriety, she'll get hired at some Hollywood place and charge $1,000 to get your hair washed, blow dried, and cut. Sebastian,
yeah, I forget his name. Somebody about somebody rubbing up against her there too. I get.
All right, my friends. Great show. We had a lot of fun. You know, it's funny. When as a young man, I was a stupid, ignorant fool as a sailor. So when, and then I got to work a little bit. I got to put my foot in certain places. It's like, so when I see this, I'm like, hey, I know about that. I know how these things happen. It's kind of fun. For those out there, Jason Whitlock, his latest podcast has great take on it. Marcellus Wiley, great takes. Both of them were there and got to interact with both of these players, and they have their thoughts. Marcellus Wiley has a great take. His is about 20 minutes long. Jason Whitlock's about an hour long. Lots of articles out there. We're going to hear a lot about this. But to recap, you know, the boat games are boat gamesmanship. We're in accordance, in agreement, Bill and I. It needs to change the college football playoff system. It's a scam. It's Bill. To be unbiased, we can unbiasedly say it's tilted to favor certain teams. And that's not fair. And with all the money involved, it will change. And NIL will exponentially force this change. Black Monday, Gerard Mayo. I feel bad for him. And I'm not a fan of his. I thought he was going to be a crappy coach. But unless he completely lost that locker room, he should have been given at least one more year. But you can't argue the hire with all the missteps he made, from how he threw his people on his coaching staff under the bus, how he threw the players under the bus, how he would sit there and was indecisive at times, whether it was on the field play calling or how he dealt with the pressers. He was not ready for prime time, as they used to say for Saturday Night Live. And Sex, Lies, and Undisputed. That's going to be fun to watch, baby. And with that, I am William W.R. Actually, before I do that, you can find this podcast and others at grumbleysmedia.com, as well as our social media outlets, YouTube, Pandora, Spotify, and Apple, as well as the conservative video site Rumble. We are under the profile handle grumbleysmedia.com. You can find me as well with my conservative talk show and my culture and politics talk show as well. I am William Del Pilar. For Bill Ross and myself, this is Points on the Board. And until next week, we bid you adieu.